This past month, Christianity lost a prophetic voice when Chuck Colson passed into eternity at the age of 80. Colson gained popularity, and I guess you could say notoriety, as a member of President Richard Nixon's administration. In the wake of the Watergate scandal, he came to know Christ as his Lord and Savior, and Colson was never the same. After being released from federal prison for his role in Watergate, Colson founded Prison Fellowship, became a sought-after public speaker, and wrote a number of books. He was what some might call a Christian celebrity, although Colson himself would be the first to object to such a designation. He wrote something I'd like to share with you this morning from his book, Loving God. For a generation, Western society has been obsessed with the search for self. We have turned the age-old philosophical question about the meaning of life into a modern growth industry. Popular literature rides the wave of best-selling titles that guarantee success with everything from making money to firming up flabby thighs. This not-so-magnificent obsession to find ourselves has spawned a whole set of counterfeit values. We worship fame, success, materialism, and celebrity. We want to live for success, to look out for number one, and we don't mind winning through intimidation. However, this self-conscious world is in desperate straits. Each new promise leads only to a frustrating paradox. The self-fulfillment fads of the 70s led to self-absorption and isolation rather than the fuller, liberated lives they predicted. The technology created to lead humanity into this new promised land may instead obliterate us and our planet in a giant mushroom cloud. 3 decades of seemingly limitless affluence have succeeded only in sucking our culture dry, leaving it spiritually empty and economically weakened. Our world is filled with self-absorbed, frightened, hollow people. And in the midst of all this, we have the church, those who follow Christ. For the church, this ought to be our hour of opportunity. The church alone can provide a moral vision to a wandering people. The church alone can step into the vacuum and demonstrate that there is a sovereign, living God who is the source of truth. But the church is in almost as much trouble as our culture. For the church has bought into the same value system: success, fame, materialism, and celebrity. We watch the leading churches and the leading Christians for our cues. We want to emulate the best-known preachers with the biggest sanctuaries and the grandest edifices. Preoccupation with these values has also perverted the church's message. The assistant to one renowned media pastor, when asked the key to this man's success, replied, "Without hesitation, we give the people what they want." This heresy is at the root of the most dangerous message preached today, the "what's in it for me" gospel. They're strong words, but it's true. Ours is a celebrity culture. We're a superstar society. Look around. Who are the highest paid people in America today? Most of them are actors and actresses, athletes or musicians. They're the superstars. They're the ones that we hold up and say, "This is what I wish I could be." Fans of these celebrities follow their every move through tabloids and television shows. I think Colson was right about our culture. We worship celebrity and those who hold that status. I think he was right about something else, too, that this rise of celebrity status has crept its way into the church. The temptation to make Christian superstars out of Christ's servants is dangerous, both for the servant and for the flock. Now, this tendency isn't new. In fact, it dates all the way back to the early days of the Christian church. And our text for this morning speaks to the perils of popularity and how to properly defuse this potentially dangerous situation. I'd like you to turn, if you haven't gone there already, to Acts chapter 14, that passage that we read earlier. Acts chapter 14, to give you the background here, this is the first missionary journey of the Apostle Paul. He has gone out with his mentor, a man named Barnabas. At first, they went to the island of Cyprus, which was Barnabas' home territory. And then they moved up into what they called at that time southern Galatia. They had preached at the port city of Pisidian Antioch. They moved inland to the city of Iconium. And now they've made their way to the very small town of Lystra. Now, we've already read what happened there. And this story might sound strange to us or even unbelievable. Many critical scholars have tried to dismiss this account as fabricated or at the very least exaggerated. But there's no reason to doubt the accuracy of this account when you take into consideration the history of the little town of Lystra. It actually makes perfect sense. And if we take an honest look at what happened there, we must admit that it strikes close to home, probably more than we would like to admit. I'd like to consider three perils that were faced here by Paul and Barnabas, and then how that applies to us today. First of all, celebrity status is foolish. It's difficult to read this account without smiling or chuckling at the silly reaction of the crowd. Now, granted, there was a miracle. As Paul is speaking to the people, he notices a man in the crowd who was crippled from birth. He had never walked. And this is a small town. Listen, it was a tiny little town. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew that cripple. And Paul, his eyes met that man. And he perceived that that man had faith. He perceived that that man was accepting what he believed. And under divine inspiration, Paul says, "You there, stand up and walk." Now, some of the folks might have thought, poor guy doesn't know who he's talking to. There's a story this last year that there was a speech given by our vice president. And I believe it was to a veterans organization. And I give him credit for trying to honor the guy that put it all together. He was a veteran who was in a wheelchair. He had been injured in battle and could not walk. And the vice president called him out by name and said, "Stand up so we can honor you properly." Of course, everybody laughed at that because the poor fellow couldn't stand. Maybe that's what the folks at Lystra were thinking. This preacher overstepped himself. Now, this guy can't walk. He's never walked. But lo and behold, this man stands to his feet and for the first time takes steps. He begins to walk. This is a miracle. Now, this isn't the first time such a miracle has taken place in the Bible. Earlier in the book of Acts, we saw Peter and John do the same thing. Jesus did this quite often in his ministry. It's not like it's never happened before. But notice what the people do. They are so excited, they want to offer sacrifices to Paul and Barnabas. They're saying, "The gods have come among us. Let's build them a temple. Let's sacrifice. Let's worship them." Sounds silly, doesn't it? Sounds very foolish. Well, John Stott shed some light on the situation. About 50 years previously to this occasion, the Latin poet Ovid had narrated in his book, The Metamorphoses, an ancient local legend. It seems that the supreme god that the Bible calls Zeus and his son Hermes. Now, we know them as Jupiter and Mercury. This was the chief Roman god. And his son visited the hill country there in southern Galatia, disguised as mortal men. They went from place to place seeking hospitality, but everywhere they went, the people turned them away. Until they arrive at this elderly couple's home in Lystra. Their names were Bacchus and Philemon. Now this aged couple, even though they didn't have much, their house wasn't impressive, they were not wealthy, but they welcomed in these two strangers, showed them hospitality. Well, Jupiter and Mercury, they were so impressed by what this couple did that they turned their little house into a temple. They promised that when this couple died, they would be planted as oak trees out in front of the temple so that they would go on for years to come. And they wiped out all of the ingrates who wouldn't open their doors to them. All right? This is the only legend of that time that took place in Lystra. So you know the people of Lystra know the story. And now they're thinking, we're not going to get caught again. If this is a repeat of the gods coming, let's bring out the brass band and celebrate. Let's give them the red carpet treatment. So maybe we can cut them a little bit of slack. Can understand why they would react so strongly. But seriously, worship these people? I mean, it's one thing to stand and applaud and say, hey, that was great. But give them worship? Unfortunately, that's a part of our human nature. People want to treat spiritual leaders as gods. It happened to Peter in Acts chapter 10. It's happening here to Paul and Barnabas. You go through the book of Revelation, and on two separate occasions, the apostle John falls down to worship at the feet of an angel. And the angel has to say, hey, get up. Don't worship me. I'm not the one you should be worshiping. Why are we so apt to do this? Well, if we get overly impressed while in the presence of celebrities, it may be because we worship stardom and those individuals who've reached it because of our own feelings of inadequacy. If we're not careful, we'll erect secret idols in our own minds. A low self-image can cause us to have a fixation on someone else. We kind of live our dreams through them. Maybe we're not so successful, but they are, and so we kind of project ourselves to them. But let the television be turned off. Let the athletes get older and lose some of his skills. Let the stars fall. And where are we? We're back in that fragile shell, struggling for existence. Some of the loneliest people out there no longer believe in themselves. They're trying to find their significance in somebody else. And so they adopt a celebrity to kind of live their life through. But it's foolish. It doesn't last. It doesn't fulfill. And so many of these will move from one celebrity to the next. Whoever is the big name at the time, that's who they follow. They're trying to find fulfillment in something that won't fulfill. And not only is celebrity status foolish, it's also false. There is no such thing as a superstar, humanly speaking. Notice how Paul and Barnabas reacted, verses 14 and 15. When the people came out to worship them, it says they tore their clothes. They rushed out in the crowd and said, what are you doing? Don't worship us. We're human. Later in the letter to the Corinthians, to a group of Christians who were doing much of the same thing, Paul had to write, what after all is Apollos and what is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe as the Lord assigned each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. Notice what he says here. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, only God who makes things grow. See, there's no doubt that these early Christian disciples did not consider themselves worthy of sainthood, worthy of worship, this kind of exalted treatment that we have given them in the subsequent centuries. They were uncomfortable with it. They didn't want it. They saw themselves as men simply doing God's work. And it was God who performed the miracles. It was God who changed lives. It was God who made the church grow. I think of this, I think of James 5:17. James writes, Elijah was a man just like us. He was human. Oh, sure, he did all these wonderful things. And he was one of those, he was right up there with Moses in the eyes of many Jews. Oh, you know, they were just almost not even human. They exalted them so high, and James brings them down to earth. He says, Elijah was a man just like us. And as we go through the pages of Scripture and you read about the men and women, with the exception of Jesus Christ, because He was God, but the human beings throughout Scripture, they're human. They had failings just as we do. They were weak just as we are. They weren't celebrities. They weren't superstars. I can remember my mom always saying, if I started thinking of somebody more highly than I ought, they put their pants on just like you do, one leg at a time. Right? They're human. We don't need to give them some kind of elevated status. Chuck Swindoll applies this principle to today's church. He writes, refuse to deify anyone in the ministry. Now, word deify means make like God. Many folks make the mistake of allowing admiration to grow into exaltation. And that's a bad choice. I don't care how gifted, how capable, or how much a minister is meant to you, if you exalt that person beyond proper bounds, you will fall further than anyone if he falls. Keep ministers off the pedestal. Thrones are for kings and queens. Worship is for the living God. Pedestals are for vases and flowers and sculpted busts of men and women who are now dead. Don't enthrone your pastor or anyone else for that matter. Now, does this mean you don't respect him? Absolutely not. Does that mean you don't appreciate his gifts and admire his skills? Hardly. Respect for any God-appointed office is healthy. Without it, the church will not move forward. Respect is not only noble and necessary, it's biblical. I think people who submit to godly leadership and appreciate the gifts of those in ministry are mature and they're discerning. You are wise to acknowledge God's hand in any gifted minister's life, to model his example, to learn from his instruction. But all the time that you learn and follow and respect, keep in mind that he's a human being just like you. Take it from me, it's very uncomfortable to be treated like a king. I should add, it's not much fun being treated like a bum either. And as with so many things in life, the truth seems to be somewhere in the middle. Don't treat a minister like a celebrity or a superstar. It's just not true. Now, I think it's a good time to address those on the other side of the equation. You know, if you find yourself in some form of Christian service, and this isn't just limited to pastors, although it certainly includes them, it's easy to allow the admiration and the accolades of others to go to your head. We begin believing our own press, and when that happens, watch out. There's nothing more dangerous than power in the service of arrogance. Believe me, this is no small matter. Many have been destroyed in their walk with God simply because the exercise of power was not controlled by humility. Power without humility is anything but a blessing. To really know the power of God is to be keenly aware that we've done nothing to deserve it. We've simply received a gift. Gratitude, not pride, is the only appropriate response. The power is not ours, though we are given the freedom by God to use it. When we truly walk with God, Our only desire is to serve Him, to serve His kingdom. Now, maybe that's why Paul writes in 1 Timothy 3:6 concerning a prospective church leader, he must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. See, pride is a perilous pitfall, especially to those who are being used by God and appreciated by those they serve. You know, we can all think of those in God's service who let it go to their head and how they lived the truth of Proverbs 16:18. Pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Once again, I go back to Swindoll's writing. He's got good advice for those who would fall into this trap. He says, while I'm still on the subject, let me give advice for those who are in ministry. Stay off the pedestal. Don't get comfortable up there. Keep crawling down. If you start liking it up there, I know a great solution. Have a long conversation with your wife. If that doesn't humble you, talk with your teenagers. That never fails to bring the high and mighty down to earth and fast. So whether you are behind a pulpit or you're sitting in a pew, avoid the temptation of bestowing celebrity status on those who serve the Lord. Learn a lesson from the people there at Lystra. You see, this entire movement is so subtle, it's actually more dangerous than some of the opposition that you find recorded in the book of Acts. Because it can creep in and it seems good, it seems positive, but it is actually quite perilous. So you see now how celebrity status is foolish, how it's false. Thirdly, I'd like to demonstrate how it can be very fickle as well. In this story, and what might be the most unbelievable part of this whole story, is what happens next. You start out with this amazing miracle. The people react. They want to worship Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas come out and say, no, don't worship us. We're not gods. We're simply men. But let us tell you about the real God. It says, even with all of their words, they barely kept the people from sacrificing to them and exalting them as gods. In the very next verse, we read that Jews from Iconium and Pisidian Antioch that didn't like what Paul and Barnabas were doing, they come to Lystra, and in a very short period of time, they turn that crowd. And the next thing you know, they've picked up stones. They stone Paul. They figure he's dead. They drag him out, dump him outside of town. He goes from being exalted as God to being stoned to death. Or at least they thought they did. Turns out that they didn't kill him. But not for lack of effort. That's quite a roller coaster ride, don't you think? You're way up here, people think you're God. And now you're way down here, people want you dead. And that's how celebrity status can be. You know, this is a good example of the ministry. You're in the penthouse one minute and outhouse the next. In the morning, they're singing your praises, and then before dark, they're stoning you. I remember hearing that in some churches, favorite meal on Sunday afternoon is roast pastor. They go home and pick apart what the preacher had to say, or maybe what he was wearing, or who knows what. Fair or not, celebrity status is fickle. They say, why? How could those people turn so quickly? Maybe they were offended. Maybe they were offended at the fact that here we tried to worship you guys, we tried to treat you guys like gods, and you threw it back in our face. Maybe they were embarrassed by that. They were made to look foolish, and then they felt resentful. And that happens sometimes. When you have to correct somebody's view, maybe it has to do with their view of God, or maybe it has to do with their view of yourself. Sometimes they don't take that well, and that can build resentment. And that can happen today, too. People who deify human leaders can also turn on them when they don't fit into their mold. See, what happens when you put celebrity status on someone, when you elevate somebody higher than they should, you really aren't looking at them anymore. You're looking at your view of them, your idealized view. And when they don't live up to that, you're devastated. And I think that's how that celebrity status can turn so fast. Think about it in our own culture. Think about people, maybe a ball player, or maybe a movie star or some musician that's on the top of the world. And then something happens. Maybe they commit a crime or they're caught up into something and all of a sudden nobody talks about them anymore. They're completely gone from the arena. It can happen so fast. And that's why it's so important that ministry is not about pleasing people. See, the true servant of God is more interested in pleasing his master than his fellow subjects. True ministry is God-pleasing, not man-pleasing. That church or that minister about whom it was said, we give the people what they want, that might be good business sense. That's not good ministry sense. That's not what we're called to do. We're not called to give people what they want. We're not called to tell people what they want to hear. Would you like a doctor that only told you what you wanted to hear? You know, you came in and had some tests run. Doctor says, oh, you're fine. Now, that might make you feel good at the moment, but is that really what you want if you're not fine? Wouldn't you rather have a doctor tell you the truth and say, hey, we got to do something about this? Ministry is the same. So we've got to be careful that our focus in ministry is not on a man. It's not on building up our ego or our reputation. It's about serving Christ. Now, as you know, this church is known as Texas Christian Church. I get asked all the time, why is a church in the middle of Illinois called Texas? Well, it's part of Texas Township, and it's been called that for a long, long time. Now, in keeping with this name, some of you might have noticed, I don't know if it's still out here or not, but somebody put up a little cross, said Texas Christian Church, and they said the Lone Star Church, in keeping with the Lone Star State of Texas. I think that's good. Because there is only one star. There's only one star in this church, and that is Jesus Christ. We've adopted that as our logo, where Jesus Christ is the Lone Star. He is the one that we worship. He is the one that we follow. There is no room for any other star in the Christian church. We read in Exodus 34:14, Moses tells the Israelites, do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. Isaiah 42:8 says, I am the Lord, this is my name. I will not give my glory to another or my praise to idols. And a few chapters later, Isaiah 48:11 says, I will not share my glory with idols. See, it is foolish to lift any man or woman to the status of superstar in the church. See, we're all human. That's all we are. We're human beings, sinners saved by grace, that God is choosing to use in a particular way. And at some point along the way, we're going to fall. It's going to happen. But if you're leaning too much on the human, you're going to fall with them. And that's the danger. That's the peril. See, it's not only a foolish thing, it's dangerous as well. And if the Lord uses you in some powerful or positive way, others might try to make a celebrity out of you, just like the folks at Lystra did with Barnabas and Paul. And I would just tell you, follow their lead. Don't let them do it. It's not healthy for them. As Paul found out himself later, it wasn't too healthy for him either. If you appreciate the way the Lord is using people in your life, whether it's this church or somewhere else, don't put them on a pedestal that they neither deserve nor desire. And even if they desire it, don't do it anyway. Keep the praise and the credit going where it belongs, to the Lord. He is the one we worship. He and He alone. There's only one room. There's only room for one star. And His name is Jesus. I want you folks to do me a favor. Do yourselves a favor. When you go out in the community, please don't refer to this as my church. Don't say this is Scott Marsh's church. This is not my church. Oh, I'm glad to be a part of it. I am thankful that God has led us here. But this is not my church. This is His church. And whatever good has happened here has happened because God is at work. Now, when somebody blows it, you can blame me for that. But when something good happens, it is because God is doing it. It is God who makes things grow. He is the lone star here. He is the one we worship, and we need to keep it that way. Our invitation hymn this morning is hymn number 165. This is a very good reason why we should only give the kind of status and the honor and the glory, because Jesus never fails. That first verse says, earthly friends may prove untrue. You can put earthly leaders in there too. They will fall, they will fail, but Jesus never fails. And I hope this is a needed reminder for us. Keep our eyes where they need to be. Jesus is the only star. He's the only one we worship. Now, as we sing this first verse, the invitation goes out. If you've never let Jesus be the star of your life, you can do that today. Say, I want to acknowledge Jesus as my Lord, my Savior. If you've never done that and you want to do that, I invite you to come. If you would like to come and place your membership here at Texas Christian Church, this is the time to do it. As we sing this first verse, you meet me here in the front.